Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for Rural Grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. I'm Liz Carlson. I'm the Rural Praxis Audio Conference Coordinator, and I'm calling from Duluth, Minnesota today. Thank you all for joining us. Our topic for discussion today is utilizing volunteers in a rural community. And I'm thrilled to be joined on the line by three colleagues. Melissa Skaya is the Praxis Technical Assistance Provider, and she comes to us regularly on conference calls, and maybe many of you are familiar with her voice or perhaps have met her, but she is a regular speaker on our calls. You're with us, right, Melissa?
Yep, I'm here.
Hi, welcome. And we are also pleased to welcome our co-speakers on the line today, Allison Smith-Estelle and Mitzi Voracek. They are joining us from Red Lodge, Montana. They are a rural domestic violence program, and they are bringing their rural expertise to the call today to start a little bit of a dialogue and have some thinking, share some experience around working with volunteers in rural communities. So welcome, Mitzi and Allison.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Hi. Hi there. I'm not going to take any time away from our discussion today by introducing Mitzi and Allison. The bio was in the binder that all of you should have received. And so I wonder if, Melissa, you would just get our call started with, you know, further kind of grounding in the topic and just jump in.
Sure. So why don't we have Mitzi and Allison start just to talk a little bit about thinking about what's the importance of volunteers in a program, and also thinking about are organizations ready, how should we be thinking about it. So I'm kind of asking you to think about volunteers on a sort of broad basis, first off.
Mitzi speaking. I've been working in the battered women's movement for about almost 30 years now. I think I'm one of the oldest people at most of the conferences I go to. One of the things that I believe very strongly is that this whole movement was begun by volunteers, started by people in the 60s and 70s who came together to really begin to solve the problems of battering and to provide services for women at that time. And so we have a grassroots volunteer base philosophically. I think the movement does across the country. So my belief is that volunteers are crucial to this movement.
And I'll just add, you know, for us at least, we've seen an increasing number of clients over the years, and yet, you know, for many of our programs, our budgets stay pretty stagnant. And so, you know, to meet that increasing demand in an environment of limited human power, you know, your volunteers are just critical to make sure that we can continue to provide really good quality services for our clients.
Okay, so then when we think about our organization and thinking about assessing volunteers and, you know, and how is our agency thought about by the community and just an organizational sort of assessment look, can you both of you say a little bit about that?
Well, I would think that each community is going to be a little bit different in terms of who they recruit for volunteers. Clearly, the organization itself, the domestic violence sexual assault organization, needs to have some kind of public affairs presence within the community so that people know about them. Otherwise, the only volunteers that are going to be recruited are going to be those that are good friends of the staff. And, of course, we need a wide variety and a diversity of volunteers to do the kind of work that we do.
So I guess the first thing in assessing the public image of your agency is, do you have a public image? Are you known in your community? And if you are and the image is good, then fantastic. You have a really good platform to, you know, build your volunteer corps. If you're not well known in the community, you know, local newspapers are a good avenue for getting your word out about who you are, what you do, what your mission is. Certainly going and talking to church groups, community groups, you know, but for us, you know, we have something in our local newspaper, I would say every week. It's a weekly newspaper. And you know, some people say, geez, you all are in the paper all the time, but that's the way that we reach new people every week that may have never heard of us, or, you know, something in a newspaper article will grab their attention, and they'll decide to give us a call, either as a client or as a potential volunteer. So, you know, making sure that your name is out there in the community is important.
The other thing that we have the luxury of writing our own stories for the newspaper. It's a weekly with a very small staff, and it's a rural area, and so we send out press releases that are really the stories that we want to appear, and the tagline at the end of every story that goes into the newspaper is our helpline number and our office number. A helpline for, and we say something to the effect of, if you or someone you know is in an abusive relationship, please call our 24/7 helpline. If you want further information about volunteering or the program, call, and we give the office number. So that those numbers are out there on a weekly basis for people to call.
Okay, so then when you think about really thinking about how it is then as an organization we're going to recruit volunteers and think about the purpose of volunteers. I know both of you have vast sort of experience with this. Can you just sort of really talk us through this big issue of recruiting volunteers sort of in a more detailed way?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, this probably sounds very obvious, but you got to figure out what you need. You know, do you need people on your hotline? Do you need somebody to come in and organize all your internal systems? Do you need someone for filing? Do you need somebody to run your fundraiser? So figure out what skill sets you're looking for. And then, you know, there are a lot of different ways to recruit. One is just kind of the blanket approach where through press releases, through talks to the community, you just are advertising your need. And I think one of the PowerPoint slides, you know, talks about brochures, posters, speaking to groups, notices in media, and word of mouth. There are going to be other times when you need specific skills. So perhaps you need someone with legal expertise to come and do some training for your staff or help with protection orders, something like that. And then you're going to want to do more targeted recruitment, you know, which is going to be more talking to people you know and connecting the dots in your community.
The other thing is I think that many people want to volunteer. They don't quite know how to, and it might be at a time in their life when they're not ready to volunteer. So I think that what we have done over the years that we have been recruiting volunteers is always keeping our eyes on who's in the community that we really would like to have come and volunteer, and in many ways talk them through it over, and some, in one instance it was one of our best helpline volunteers. It was several years of sitting in the dentist chair. She was a dental hygienist, and every time I sat there I said, you know, told her what we were doing. Eventually came on board, but it was about 3 or 4 years before she did, and it was a time when her kids went off to school and she had the time to do it. I think it's also getting people at the times that they are ready to do it, which is pretty critical.
Right, and so in some ways you're kind of, you know, it's part of our own sort of personal connections and how that's really, really important sort of in rural communities, because often we as programs also know each other.
Well, and you know, one of the biggest issues with any kind of a volunteer program is it does take a lot of time and effort to get it up and running, and that's an outlay of human resources that many programs have a very difficult time doing when you are doing direct service all the time. And you know, doing emergency services, it's hard to rise up above the flood and try to begin to think about a recruiting of volunteers. I think Allison and I had the luxury, I guess, of starting this program very slowly, beginning about 10, 11 years ago. And we were volunteers. Allison and I were volunteers for the first 4 years of the program ourselves, and it became really clear once we began to get some funding that we could not do the work of the funders, the projects that we had gone for funding for, and she and I could not do this helpline 24/7 between the two of us. I mean, there was no break at all. And so that was really the beginning of our looking at how do we recruit volunteers and what are we going to use them for. And for us, having volunteers staff our helpline has been critical to our operations.
Right. So in some ways, it's helpful because, you know, it relieves us in terms of the work that we need to do. And it also becomes our incentive, right, to recruit volunteers when we're just feeling sort of overwhelmed by trying to do everything ourselves. Missy, you kind of mentioned, you know, about how you started slowly, you and Allison. Can you just, like, if a program right now is doing very little with volunteers, like, can you describe what's one of the first things that you did?
Well, interestingly enough, the first thing that we did when we recruited volunteers was put out a press release saying that we were looking for volunteers.
Okay.
But then I think Allison and I also talked to everybody we knew, saying that we were going to do a volunteer training. It was going to be a lengthy, intensive training. We had to prepare people for that because, you know, some of the other nonprofits, if you're going into some of the nonprofits, the training might be an evening or a couple of evenings, and then you're trained after 6 hours or 4 to 6 hours. With domestic violence volunteers, it's a lengthy training. I mean, we do an in-classroom, interactive, 24-hour training, and then a significant amount of on-the-job training after that, and then monthly trainings. You know, we do that. And so it's a significant commitment that people have to make. And so letting them know up front what they're in for. I think in rural communities, often people are pretty prepared to do that. If you've got a volunteer fire department, or an EMT, you know what that takes. People know the kind of training that takes. So many people are prepared for that, but a lot of people are not. So we talked to everybody we knew, talked to many of the ministers around town, telling them we were doing this, talked to the civic clubs, and I don't mean that we actually gave talks and speeches to these civic clubs and churches, but made the phone calls saying this is what's happening. And Allison and I thought that we could do this training if we got at least four people. If we got four people, we could do this high intense 24-hour plus all the follow-up after that. And our first class had, was it 12 people, Allison? I mean, it was really, we couldn't
yep.
believe it. And many people who showed up, we didn't know. They had come because they cared about this issue. We also did before we did the training, we had kind of an open house, and we said, come and learn about our programs and learn about what's going to happen in the volunteer training. And we had a significant number of people show up for that, too. And that wasn't a training. That was just, this is what we're looking for. This is what we do. We were shocked at how many people showed up.
Allison, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think
okay.
that's quite comprehensive.
Okay. So just also thinking about volunteer recruitment, one of the things we did with our staff and our board is we did this exercise, and this is also on the slides, called this concentric circles exercise, where we literally, you just draw three circles and three rings, and we began just to identify the people, the groups, and the organizations who we thought were the most likely to volunteer for us in terms of doing targeted recruitment. So the inner ring was the people who we thought, you know, were most likely. The challenge that we realized, though, after we had done that, the people who were in the inner ring, we also realized were the people who were volunteering in so many other ways in our community. And so it was, sometimes it's a bit, you know, you feel, have a bit of guilt once you go ask them to volunteer for another thing to participate in the community, but we also just thought about, you know, who is it that we thought were the people who were closest to us and our issue. But then we also, the third ring really pushed us to think about non-traditional groups, and we decided that we wanted to sort of start there in many ways to try and just reach out our base in many ways in terms of thinking about who we were going to do volunteer recruitment with.
You know, I think that makes a lot of sense, Melissa. You know, if we think about the national statistics of how many women are battered, and obviously all of us are connected to someone. If we haven't been battered, we know people who have been. So, you know, you never know who's going to show up and why they're going to come.
Right.
So, you know, don't discount any, you know, any potential group of people in your community Right. And as Mitzi said, you know, we've now trained, I would say, 65 people over the past 4 or 5 years. And, you know, at least 15 were people that neither of us had ever met. And we're both pretty connected with our county and with our community. You know, people coming out of the woodwork.
Right. Can I ask you just about your local newspaper? This is a curiosity question, but I bet you it's similar in your community. About the newspaper now, are you, I know every newspaper has sort of a community bulletin section. Is that the section that you're doing the weekly in, or are you paying for it? Or
no, we don't pay for anything. We're just philosophically opposed to ever paying for any media coverage at all, because we feel strongly that the media should support nonprofits, and that
sure.
so far has worked well for us. We're in community briefs, but we also write press releases, you know,
right.
that get published as articles.
Right.
And op-ed pieces, opinion editorial pieces. We try to do several of those a year, and right now for Domestic Violence Awareness Month, we will have 3 op-eds local paper, and that's that weekly paper. And then, of course, we are within 60 miles from a larger city, Billings, which has a daily paper, and they don't like to cover the rural areas very much. I mean, they'll give us some lip service occasionally, but they will. The opinion editorial editor, who's got a health-based background, is interested in the work that we do. And so we do op-ed pieces for the Gazette also, again, with our tagline or asking them to always put a sidebar with our helpline numbers and the national helpline number, the national hotline, the shelter in Billings, making sure that those resources are always there for everything that we do so people have a number to call. So yeah, but we write our own stories, and I don't know how many papers do that. Probably more and more now that the newspaper world is shrinking.
And, you know, the other thing, the op-eds that Mitzi mentions, you don't have to create those. You know, there are national organizations that are churning out, you know, sample press releases for Domestic Violence Awareness Month, Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So it really truly is just filling in your local information, maybe a local quote from your sheriff or from the executive director of your organization, and putting those out into the media. Again, you know, Mitzi talked a little earlier about how hard it is to lift our head above, you know, the intensity of the direct service work that we do, to think about press releases and to think about recruiting volunteers. But it really is important to pause, stop, lift your head up, and do some of this laying the groundwork that eventually is going to be really beneficial to your program.
And, you know, again, I think we had the luxury of the two of us being volunteers to begin with. This program was not funded. A church gave us $600, and a civic group gave us $200, and that was our first, I think, in 2001, that was our first funding. It allowed us to do some copying, and those were the kinds of things that were happening. So we were volunteers to begin with, and that was helpful. And I spent many years at the Houston Area Women's Center, which had begun out of the women's movement of the mid to late 70s and was started there by all volunteers. So we come from that. Volunteers are the most important things that we have, not just to do the work of not just to do the actual direct service work, but to be the people out in the community spreading the education about what this is all about. We tell all of our volunteers, whether they come back and do direct service for us or not, that they are our emissaries out there, that they can educate this community. And, you know, when I first got here, I moved here from Houston 12 years ago, and I thought, if we can't do something in an area, that a town that's at that time was less than 2,000 people, and a county with 9,000, huge geographic county with 9,000, if we can't do something here, then it can't be done, because we can touch individually almost every person when the population is that low. But I found that it was more difficult than I thought when I first got here, you know, when you come from a city of millions. to in a rural area. You have all these ideas about how things ought to be done, and it's been a real learning experience for me.
So I don't know if we said this earlier, but I just want to clarify. So just the size of your community then, Mitzi, is it, it's about 9,000 then, just to give people an idea of the context of the community you come from?
The whole county is about 9,000 people, made up of six incorporated towns and then smaller unincorporated communities.
Okay. Okay. So before we go into screening of volunteers, I think that's kind of a whole new subject. I do want to just, it's about, my clock says 12:24. I just want to stop right now and just see if there's any questions on what we've talked about so far. So we've sort of talked about this broad overall look at volunteerism in rural areas, but also we've talked quite extensively about recruitment. So any questions thus far or any other comments that people want to share about what they've done in their local community? So we can have the lines open.
Yep, certainly. We welcome your questions or comments. If you have something you'd like to share, please press the number 1 on your telephone, and that will open your phone line up individually. And please, if you can, remember to say your name and where you're calling from so we can get a little idea of who all is on the line. While we wait for the operator to let us know if there are any questions in the queue, Allison, you talked about 9,000 people in your county. How large, what's the square mileage for your county? Do you happen to know?
I should have that at the tip of my brain. Is it about 1,900 square miles, Mitzi?
Something like that. It's huge. I mean, it's just the amount of travel that we do is really unbelievable.
Yeah, right. And do you have volunteers that are coming a long way to your program?
Yes, and I've asked this year we've asked them to not only talk about the miles, to record the mileage that they're doing when they come to do services, but also the time it takes to travel, so that we can get a better handle on that. And it's pretty significant so far.
Right. And then do you use that information for your kind of reporting purposes to funders?
I think that our new the new program of Avid is asking for that.
Yes, it is.
Oh, here's the square miles. One of my staff members who's on the listening in on the other line has been and said 62 square miles.
Wow. Yep. That's huge. That's a huge area.
Yeah, I'm actually Googling it right now. The state of Connecticut is about 5,000 square miles, so we're about 40% the size of the state of Connecticut. And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people on the call whose geographic ranges are much larger than that. If there's anybody on from Alaska, they're probably laughing at 2,000 square miles.
I remember one call that we were on when somebody from Arizona talked about being 100 miles from the nearest hospital. You know, so I guess we sit in the lap of luxury with 2,000 plus square miles here.
It's all relative.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. Are there any other questions or comments at this time, Stephanie?
Not at this time.
Okay, all right. So let's go ahead and move into the dialogue around screening volunteers, and we'll step again in probably another 20 or 25 minutes. Why don't the three of you just continue with your discussion?
Okay, so let's start to talk then a little bit about how we screen for volunteers and how you choose who's going to volunteer. What are some of the guidelines around that within your community, with your agency, the process? Let's just sort of dive into that.
Well, I think one thing to start with is you do need to choose your volunteers. So we've been talking about the importance of volunteers and how overworked all of us are, so we might be inclined to take anybody who walks through the door. And I think we have to be careful with that. You know, certainly worst-case scenario, a perpetrator of domestic violence could come in wanting to be a volunteer to learn more about what you do or where his wife is. You know, God forbid, that's not very typical. But, you know, we have had people come in wanting to volunteer that we have decided for one reason or another it's just not a good fit. You know, we've also had people that have made it through the screening that later on we've had to tell them it's not a good fit.
Allison, I just have you just for a minute, because I just want you to say a little bit more about that. Can you just sort of give an example of someone who, I mean, I don't know if you had sort of have them in your memory, but just to think through that a little bit more in terms of, like, can you do a little bit of description of, like, why you decided not that person? And then also, I guess, I think the real sort of skill in is what do you say and how do you say it?
Yeah.
It's a very, very tricky kind of thing to do. I think maybe what we need to do is go through what the process is and why some people get through that process, and then how we continue to work with them in other ways. Our process is extreme screening. They have to do an application, and that application includes references, both professional and friends' references, just as you would a job application. We then, and so that comes to us. We do a background check, a criminal background check, and we get their permission to do that. We call their references, and then we have them come in for an interview. And all of this is before they even go to the first day of training. And what we do at the interview is talk to them very specifically about the work. We ask them about their own issues dealing with domestic violence and sexual assault, and tell them that you know, they need to be in a place where their issues are not going to take paramount when they're working with other people. Although survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault can be the best of volunteers, the best that we have, but if they're still in the middle of crisis, it can be very detrimental to some of our survivors. And so we do talk about that. That does screen some people out, but we also tell them that if they want to go through the training, they certainly can do that, because we believe our training is this massive education we want to have everybody in our county go through. So sometimes volunteers, once they get into training, particularly if they are survivors and have not, the issues are still paramount in their lives, sometimes they will drop out or will come to us and say, you know, I don't think I can do this at this time. And we always say to them, this may not be the time, but there may be time in the future. And know that this is always going to be open to you to come back and do this work. So those are some of the things. But when you get to what happens with somebody who's gone all through the process and is one of your volunteers, we have a couple of examples come to my mind. One was a minister who was would have been very good, except that when she was doing an outreach project for us, was recruiting for her church at the same time, members for her church. And, of course, I heard in a small area, you hear about that all over the place. I mean, I got a lot of phone calls on that. And so I talked to her very frankly, and I said, you know, I understand the need to recruit people and to proselytize for your church, but you cannot do that. Here are our policies. You know, we are non-denominational. We don't do that. And I said, we can't have you doing that kind of thing. Perhaps there are other things you can do within your church. Have us come in and talk to your congregation. We'll always use you as a resource, but you cannot do that. We can't have you doing that. She was very gracious about it, which was very interesting. I think sometimes when you're up front with people and explain it, they understand. Another volunteer was clearly in crisis. Every time she got a call or every time she met with one of our clients was in crisis herself. And we met with her, and I simply said to her, I don't think this is the time. I see that you're in crisis, and I see that it's the stress on you is incredible, but we still want you to be one of our volunteers, an emissary in the community to talk about what we do. And she was also fine with that, but that was the one I was most nervous about. I was mad at the minister, because I think she should have known better, but the volunteer was really relieved. When I talked to her, she felt it was her duty to come and volunteer for us, and the discussion was helpful to her.
Okay, thank you for that example. Allison, did you have any that you wanted to share?
I'll just share a little bit more about our interview. We also have a couple questions in the interview that try to really get to the, you know, suss out potential volunteers' philosophy towards helping people in crisis. And we kind of do a role play of, you know, here's a scenario. How do you think you would respond? And what we're trying to get at is whether potential volunteers understand that the decisions need to be the client's decisions, that we can't tell a client what to do. We don't know what's best for someone who's experiencing domestic violence. So just trying to, you know, get at whether they're going to be, dominating and saying, well, this is what you should do versus presenting thoughts and ideas for a survivor to then make her own choice. And again, the screening, it's not foolproof. We have had people go all the way through. We've never had, not that we know of, we've never had a perpetrator or anything like that. But, you know, we don't catch everybody. But as Mitzi said, a lot of people, you know, will kind of catch themselves and realize that it's just not a good fit for one reason or another. And as hard as the conversation is, you have to have it. Because if you have somebody go through volunteer training and suddenly they're out in the community representing your organization and they're representing it badly, you've got a public relations issue on your hand. And in a small community, you know, all of us know how damaging, you know, one person can be.
Right. So I think you kind of mentioned this a little bit already, but in terms of thinking about screening volunteers, do you have agency policy? So, for example, do you have any time frame so that if, let's say, somebody's used their services, do you have any sort of numbers? You know, like, for example, some agencies say you cannot become a volunteer unless you've not used services with us for a certain amount of time. Do you have any sort of agency policies in those? Okay, can you talk about why you don't? Because I think that's helpful for people to understand your thinking about that.
Well, because everybody's experience with domestic violence is different. And for some people who were in an abusive relationship 20 years ago, they're still living it. Mm-hmm. And some people move through their process, you know, if they've gotten a lot of support, you know, can move through an abusive relationship and, you know, come out the other side, so to speak, very quickly. So, no, we just don't feel like a time frame is appropriate because everybody's experience is so different. But, you know, most people who have come to us as volunteers and who are survivors disclose that. And then, you know, we talk about it. We talk about it really honestly. Where are you in your process? Where's your perpetrator? What's the legal standing of your case? You know, we want to know.
Right.
And they're not forced to tell us anything, but we ask. And my sense is that people are usually very, very open and willing to talk about it.
Right. Are there any state guidelines in your state about certification to be an advocate, whether it's volunteer or not?
Not in Montana, no.
Okay. Okay. So, for example, we have this on the PowerPoint because a number of states have state law guidelines about how many hours that you have to be trained and a certification process. I know some states that in order to do any legal court advocacy, for example, assisting women with orders for protection, they have a very specific sort of guideline. So one of the things for programs to think about and know and understand is if there are any state law guidelines that would apply. And the same would be with any grant guidelines in that regard. And then, of course, the other space is your agency. Even if you don't have guidelines within law in your state, your agency may set those out. And I know that a number of programs have this thing about this time frame thing, and I'm glad that you know, you sort of talked that through, Allison, because it becomes this arbitrary thing where we think we're doing the right thing in terms of setting this time frame, but we could potentially miss a lot of people because we know that so many people, you know, you know, 6 months after or in the best spot in their life to be doing some work, and people will be living it many years, and people who share children with someone who's been violent and abusive will most likely experience some level of it all the time as long as they, you know, share a child or children. And so those are sort of all the things to think about.
Well, and the other thing that we do with volunteers is after every, and we have cell phones, they take, the helpline is a cell phone that they take home with them and or take wherever they go with them. But when their shift is over, we do a debriefing with them every time so that if any issues do come up, they can talk that through. And I think that is also one of the reasons that we were able to very carefully exit one of the volunteers who was really inappropriate for the job at that point in her life. It's that constant communication with them. And again, it's one of the, I hate to call it a luxury of a small rural area, but you know people better. I know I worked in Houston for many years, and that volunteer program was so huge that it was impossible to know all the volunteers or to have that kind of relationship with them. But here, in rural areas, you have a better chance of, I think, having frank talks with them. And I really think survivors make some of the best volunteers, and I'm with Allison. It's why we don't have any kind of time frame.
Can you say anything else in terms of thinking about who's the ideal volunteer? I mean, part of it, I know, ends up to be who's in your community and who's available to be a volunteer, but if you were to think about...
You know, I know the ideal volunteer.
Okay, go ahead.
It's a retired woman or man who believes in the work that we do, who has plenty of time to do it, and who is willing to do anything. That's the ideal volunteer. I was looking at volunteer trends, and it looks like the retired people have a tremendous amount of time to do that. Although most of those retired people, most of the work that they do in volunteering looks like it's with churches. But one of the ways to get around that is to have, again, being careful about being non-denominational with the program, but having a church have this be one of the projects that is their project to take on. They have to be trained very carefully so that they don't do any kind of religious trying to convert anybody at any time. But they can be very valuable for volunteers. But it is somebody who's got a lot of time.
And, you know, just to share anecdotally, our first batch of volunteers that we trained was very much that demographic. You know, retired women or women, you know, to be frank, upper middle class women who were not working full time. And that was our first batch of women. Since then, like I said, we've trained probably 65 people, and the diversity has just exploded. And so we have several men who have been through. We have several people in their 20s that have been through volunteer advocate training. You know, rich, poor, really, really the spectrum. And that's been very gratifying and satisfying to see that diversity build. But it did start, you know, with mostly retired women who had time.
Right. Well, and I also think about in terms of volunteers, our community also has a community college. And so also when we can be a learning place for them and they give back in terms of internships for the colleges in our community, we have a community college. It's a small one, but I think that that's also when I think about an ideal sort of opportunity, because most of those college students are going to go on to different places and carry some of those values, beliefs, principles, and thinking that we have as an organization to another, often a human service type organization.
Oh, absolutely. If you've got the luxury of a college, yes, those are also ideal volunteers. And like Melissa mentioned, you know, you may be able to set up a work study. We don't have a college anywhere close to us, but we had a student in our town who was doing online classes at that college far away. Anyway, we were able to do a work study with her where the university pays $7 and we paid $2 an hour. So she was staff, but, you know, at very little cost to us. But absolutely, you know, college volunteers, I mean, that's where I started the work in college. And, you know, they're eager, they want to learn.
So let's think a little bit in terms of training volunteers, in terms of what that takes in terms of our work. Or Liz, do you want me to stop at this point and take some questions since we missed the last one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's stop.
Yep. Any comments or questions at this point? If so, press 1 on your telephone to get into the question queue. And while we wait for people to get situated with that, just to clarify, I just had a couple of quick questions for the three of you. Allison and Mitzi, how many volunteers generally do you use, like in a day or at a time, or how do you kind of staff volunteers?
Well, we have, and I'm talking about direct service volunteers now. These would be ones who are, I call them our hardcore volunteers because they do the direct service work. We have approximately 16, and so at night, there's always a volunteer on the line and on weekends. So at any given time, there's always at least one major volunteer who's doing major work for us. I think at certain times, like our fundraiser, for example, we'll probably have 20 volunteers, some of whom have not gone through our in-depth training because they come, they want to do some work, they help us decorate, they clear tables, those kinds of things. During the time of our fun run, which is a big charity event in town, we probably have 10 volunteers doing various things around the fun run. So a lot of it depends on when that's happening. But when we've got big crisis, we could have 5 or 6 volunteers at one time.
Yesterday we had a staff meeting and had a volunteer come and take care of the phone lines so all staff could be in on a meeting. We've got people who edit documents for us. We've got people who weed our garden, you know, all volunteers.
And your hotline is staff 24/7?
Yes.
Right? Terrific. Great.
Yep, and it used to be, you know, that volunteers covered the helpline almost all the time. Well, in the earliest days when Mitzi and I were the only ones, we were covering it and we were volunteers. Now we have enough staff and we've really shifted how we do our helpline. But right now what we're doing is staff have it during the day and then at 5 o'clock it turns over to a volunteer who always has staff backup. So one staff member will be available if all heck breaks loose in the middle of the night and the volunteer needs some help.
I see. Got it. Thank you. That's helpful.
This is Melissa. I want to say that, too, that the same is for us because the thing about being a volunteer is that sometimes your experience of understanding the emerging issues of what's going in and out of an agency or with someone, that having that staff backup availability is really, really important. Otherwise, when volunteers get the call and they feel like they can't help, then they don't feel helpful and they don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's important.
Well, and as Mitzi mentioned earlier, you know, we gather our volunteers every month and we do some sort of formal training at every single meeting because we really feel like that continuing education is critical because there are emerging trends or some law will have changed about orders of protection, you know, and our people need to know that.
Artemis House, your line is open.
Okay, we're going to try this again. Can you hear me?
No.
Yes, can. Hi.
Oh, good. Okay, my name is Betty, and I'm a victims advocate, and I also do all the training for volunteers. And I'm really struggling. That's why I was really excited about this today, and I've really gotten some great ideas. But one of the questions I have, and I see it's on the PowerPoint, we do offer a stipend, a weekend stipend for our volunteers. Although I would really, really like not to have to pay that stipend because of budget, but I don't know how others feel about that or if any other areas are doing that as an option. That was my question.
Can you first say if you don't mind sharing, like how much the stipend is and what's the thinking about what it's for?
It's $100 for the weekend. So they take the phone on Fridays from 4:30 until Monday mornings at 8 a.m. And we do pay them, you know, of course, taxes are taken out of that. But I just really would like some feedback if other areas are doing that, if not, and mainly retaining, because we're really, the program here has been in existence for quite some time, but has really never been probably as organized as it should be. And I, too, volunteered for 2.5 years prior to coming on board part-time. So I'm really, really interested in getting this up and running in a professional manner. So I welcome your input.
This is Melissa, and I have to tell you, you're the first program I've known of that's paid people on the weekend. The only difference, I'll say, just if we can't find a volunteer for a weekend and a staff member has to take the phone, so this is an employee of the agency, we give them 3 hours of paid time just for being available. Because there is something about, you know, you can't go too far away from your organization. You can't be partying and drinking alcohol or, you know, anything like that, and you have to be available.
Absolutely.
So, but that's
and
for
we
employees,
do.
But we
right.
You're the first program, because you're saying volunteers, right? Non-employees.
In volunteers, but we're, but it's truly not, you know, when you look at it, because we're paying them.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, Allison, we have not. We have never paid our volunteers. You know, we've never even introduced the topic.
And I would really, really, I'm not sure how the board feels about that, but I would really like to get back to grassroots, you know, true volunteer work, because it truly is a volunteer, and I truly want them to volunteer because they have a vested interest, you know, not because of the $100. So we are really working on that, but we do have staff that serve as backup on the weekend, so we have to be available, you know, to back the volunteer person up. So, but thank you for your information.
Yeah, you know, it may be a little tricky for you since the payment is the norm to back out of that. The only thing I can think of is maybe do an anonymous survey of your volunteers to see how many would stop if they didn't get the payment.
That's a great idea.
You know, because you may be paying unnecessarily, you know, and they may not be saying anything. They think, hey, great, $100, but you might find that, you know, 9 out of 10 would, of course, keep volunteering.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you so much.
You know, the other thing that we have done is we split shifts. So in our earliest days, you know, our volunteers would carry the helpline phone for a week at a time. Now
wow.
We have, yeah, the hot potato, we would call it, you know, the little baby, you know, and really give up their lives in many ways for a week. We now have a big enough volunteer pool that, you know, maybe one person takes it Saturday, another person takes it Sunday, one person takes it Saturday, Sunday days, the other nights. So, you know, so point being, if you, you know, built your volunteer pool and you wouldn't, the $100 wouldn't be such a huge incentive because you're only asking somebody for 12 hours rather than 60 hours.
Exactly.
Over the weekend, you know?
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thanks for your question, Artemis House.
Stephanie, are there any other callers in the queue?
We do have additional callers in the queue. And next, we do have Safe Shelter. Your line is open.
Hi. Yeah, I was actually just going to comment. We have volunteers on the hotline as well when, you know, 24 hours when we're not, when the office is closed. We don't pay them either. And we have, actually, we have two volunteers on at all times. We have a primary person and a backup person, and then always there's a staff person that's available for them to call with any questions, or if we have to put somebody in emergency shelter or something like that, we always want to be contacted for that. And So our shifts are kind of, we do like Monday through Thursday, that starts at 5 o'clock every afternoon and goes until the morning when the office opens, and then we have a weekend shift. But the thing is they switch. So if you're the primary person for 2 days of your shift, the second half of the shift you'll be the backup person. So you won't be the first person called, you know, so that relaxes you just a little bit. And the same thing happens on the weekend. Halfway through the weekend, you're, you know, one half you'll be the primary person and the second half you'll be the backup person. And I think if I was in a situation where we were paying people and I wanted for the weekends and I wanted to get out of that, I would just start doing, you know, I think a survey would be good, and I would start doing lots of recruitment where everybody new coming on board is not getting paid. And then once you have enough people that it's not going to hurt you, then I would, you know, with warning to the old folks, make that change, you know. And you probably wouldn't lose a lot of people, but then if you did lose some, you'd be covered. But, yeah, it is volunteering. It's supposed to be volunteering.
Yeah, I think those are some great suggestions. This is Mitzi in Red Lodge. Great suggestions. And I also think there are lots of ways to pay, and I mean with that with quotation marks around them, to pay volunteers. And I think we're going to get into that later. How do you recognize volunteers? How do you keep them involved? So we'll talk about that, I guess, in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Thanks for that comment. Stephanie, are there any other questions on the line?
Yes. Next, we do have Nevada Network Against Domestic Violence. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Judy. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Judy.
I have one comment and then a question. Don't forget about the other volunteers that are already in your community, such as we did outreach to the Red Cross, and there were some shelter volunteers who weren't interested in, of course, doing the hotline because their heart was somewhere else. So we've contacted them, and they have a great program called Scrubby Bear, which teaches children proper hand-washing techniques and flu prevention. And this is a perfect time to draw in other community organizations to do maybe a train-the-trainer for your shelter volunteers and really engage in that program, and also flu prevention for adults. So we really look to other community volunteer organizations to partner with and then draw in their expertise that will just expand our programs.
Right. Thanks, Judy. So you're just really talking about all those other organizations who can help you in terms of your organizational capacity. I mean, I know for us, we also do supervised visitation, and those staff have to be CPR certified.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got people in our community to volunteer to, you know, give the CPR certification to our program. So, yeah, relying on those are really important.
And almost every rural community still has Red Cross, so they're a great organization to get involved with. My question was, I would love to receive some sample volunteer manuals, forms that are currently being used by other programs. Where can you send us to get some of these samples?
This is Liz from Praxis. So Mitzi and Allison had indicated that they're more than happy to share those resources. So if you would send me an email, any of you who are interested in receiving them, you can send an email to liz@praxisinternational.org. And I would expect that by the end of next week, I should be able to send those out to you. Melissa, do you have anything that Advocates for Family Peace make available?
Yeah, we have some of the applications and the trainer's manual that we have at our organization.
Okay, terrific.
Yeah.
So I will gather those things up and just send me an email, and I'll get them out to you as soon as I can.
And this is Mitzi. I just want to follow up on the Nevada Network. I thought those were some really great suggestions. And the other, we don't have Red Cross in our community, but one thing that we do is there are businesses, like there are a couple of local banks whose staff want to volunteer, not in direct service, but the kind of thing like babysitting, child care, when we do trainings. So there are some other avenues out there for volunteers. and that's businesses who might want to have their staff volunteer.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Mitzi. Thank you. Stephanie, are there any other callers in the queue at this time?
Not at this time, Liz.
Okay, very good. So let's go back and resume our dialogue. We have about a half an hour left for our discussion today. And let's stop one more time if we can, just before we end, and check in to see if there's any other questions on the line.
Okay, so we're into right now just talking about, we've just touched on it, about how it is that we sustain and keep and retain volunteers. What are some of the strategies and methods that you've done to do that? Do you want to, Mitzi and Nelson, why don't you start, and then I'll just add a few things after you're done.
Can I actually jump back a little bit to training?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I can't stress enough, you need to take the time to train your volunteers. You know, people with a little bit of information may be more dangerous than, you know, your volunteers need to be adequately trained, so you don't send people out there, A, to fall on their faces, but B, you know, they could potentially do some harm or they could misspeak. So I can't stress that enough. And again, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are good trainings available for new volunteers. But yeah, don't just let your volunteers out to speak for you and to serve survivors of violence with 3 or 4 hours of training.
This is Mitzi. I think one of the biggest problems that happens is victim blaming. It's so easy to do, and unless somebody is really trained about that, and that it's one thing that we really, really emphasize, that the victim is not to blame, and perpetrators have to be held responsible.
And, you know, it might be easy to think, oh, this person is so kind, they're so generous, good heart, they'll be a great volunteer, but they need, you know, they need the domestic violence training desperately, you know. So I can't overstress training.
Because we think everybody needs that training, not just our volunteers, the entire community needs that training.
Hey, thank you. So let's then start to think about sustaining and retention and recognition of volunteers.
Well, this is Mitzi. I think you keep volunteers around by acknowledging the work that they do almost constantly. If you're not paying them monetarily, we have to pay them in other ways, and you pay them by really appreciating what they do. And a part of that is keeping in close contact with them, thanking them when they're off the hotline for doing it that week. I mean, we do keep in pretty constant contact with them with phone calls, emails. I try not to do too many emails because you know how email boxes can fill up, but short, succinct emails about what's happening, and just individual emails to individual volunteers saying thanks so much for doing what you did. That was so important to us. I think that's part of what we do. We also continue to keep them because I think that they're learning something all the time. And that's those monthly meetings. They really are continuation training from our original volunteer training. We can't begin to get everything we need to train them on in a 24-hour classroom-type setting. We do a lot of on-the-job afterwards, but we have so many other topics, as Allison said, that they need to know about. And we feed them. We always feed them. I think that's very important. We put that into our budgets. Both at these short meetings, the one per month, and we feed them at volunteer training magnificently. Important to do. We do a volunteer appreciation brunch beginning of December where the staff does all the cooking and we hold it usually at someone's house and give them some gifts and tell them how important they are. And even if they haven't volunteered or done very much that year, we encourage everybody to come because we're building a community. We're building a community, and we continually tell them that. They're part of this incredible community that really is going to end violence. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but hopefully in their grandchildren's lifetimes. We're really working on that. We do a Volunteer of the Year award at our annual report to the community, and that's usually in February or March, and that's a big deal. We make sure there are pictures on the front page of the paper, and we have a plaque in our office where the names, every name of every Volunteer of the Year are on that plaque. We send them to state and national trainings if we have funding to do that, but we make that available to them if they wish to pay their own way. And we tell them that their volunteer hours in Montana are worth about $15 an hour to us. That's basically what their work is. We tell them they're really worth about $50 an hour to us, but according to the volunteer charts that we get, Montana's volunteer is really about $15 an hour. So we tell them that this is they're incredibly valuable to us. And they know they are. I mean, they really feel that, I think.
You know, the other really basic thing that's important to sustaining volunteers is make sure you have work for them. You know, there is nothing more frustrating to a volunteer to have committed to an intensive training and they've graduated from the training and they're ready to go. And, you know, then you have them come into the office to do administrative work and they sit there twiddling their thumbs. So it does require, you know, some good thinking and pre-planning to make sure that they're busy. And my mantra for our staff is always, you need to be working at your highest level. So if there's work that somebody else could be doing, save it for a volunteer, because the volunteer is tickled to death to come in and lick 1,000 envelopes, you know. They feel like they're useful. They feel like they're really contributing something, and they are. And that frees up staff to be able to do different kind of work. But make sure you keep them busy. Now, you can't control how many hotline calls are going to come, obviously, but, you know, there are a lot of ways that you can really activate volunteers. But if they're not busy, they're going to get frustrated, and they're going to go somewhere else, you know, because most volunteers truly just want to give. And if they feel like they're not giving, they'll go somewhere else to give.
So do you, in terms of some of the costs that volunteers may experience while they're being a volunteer, do any of your volunteers do any transporting, I guess, is a first question. And if so, do they get compensated in any way for that?
No. We have made a very clear policy that our staff and our volunteers do not transport, and that's a safety consideration. And I know many, if not most, programs do transport, but we've made the decision not to. So we rely on taxi services. I don't know. Sometimes we have to get pretty creative, but no, our volunteers don't transport.
Okay. And so, in terms of expenses with phones or any expenses they meet, do they ever incur any expenses at all?
You know, if they are working with a client and they happen to go to the grocery store to buy that client some dinner, we will certainly reimburse them for anything like that. But no, there are no transportation or phone expenditures. The only time we would reimburse somebody if they had to buy something for a client, which is pretty rare.
Okay.
Because we, you know, and we've, it's pretty rare because we've set up good systems in our community so our volunteers don't have to sustain any costs.
Okay.
So we have an account at the grocery store, and the volunteers know what the account number is and what the protocol is. So if they need to go buy something, you know, they don't have to put out their own money.
Okay. Can you say a little bit about, you mentioned earlier about how you get volunteers together. Did you say once a month?
Yes.
Okay. Can you say about your success in doing that and people's willingness to do that?
That's a work in progress.
Okay.
We have, we've had good success. I mean, I would say that we probably have 60 to 70% of our volunteers come every month, but we are shifting to more of a mandatory training that volunteers have to go through you know, they have to come to a certain number of advocate meetings and trainings a year to stay current.
Okay.
And the reason we've done that is we've seen it work with other nonprofits in our area. So, you know, to be a fire volunteer, you know, you are expected at the firehouse every single Monday night for a training. And they come. And so we thought, wow, if they'll come every week to do that volunteer work, we can certainly expect our volunteers to come once a month.
Okay.
And the other thing about that is we do keep track of who's there. They get credit for training hours. We keep track of all their training hours. And when they are falling short, I usually give them a call and talk to them about it. Sometimes it's a matter of a bad night. That one night, one of our volunteers is on city council, and our training night is on city council nights. Sometimes falls on city council nights. Well, that's clearly a good excuse, but she makes it up with all kinds of other trainings that she goes to. So they have a wide variety to choose from, not just what we do, but other kinds of trainings that the state, the state coalition offers. There's trainings in Billings. We have a big conference coming up, and that's all considered training for them.
So okay.
There are ways that they can get trained other than coming to those monthly meetings.
Okay. Yeah,
I like them at the monthly meetings because, again, we're building a community. And you can't build a community unless you gather together to talk over the issues.
Right. This, in our community, transportation and childcare has always been a challenge with some of our volunteers. And so some of the ways that we've done it is we've done it through web-based, through listservs and groups for all of our volunteers. And so we end up having dialogues that way, and so through an online listserv. We've also done it where what we'll do is we'll distribute, so let's say a recent article comes out about how we think about battered women, how we think about domestic violence. I remember when the Jill Davies article came out about advocacy beyond leaving and how it is we talk and think and work with better women who truly want to stay in the relationship. And so we thought, oh, this is one that would be really helpful for our volunteers. And so we mailed it to them and said, you know, we're going to have lunch and our staff are going to get together during this day and come then. Otherwise, let's discuss through our listserv. And so those are just some of the other ways in which you can just sort of think about it. But also the opportunities for professional development in the way in which is creating spaces in your budget for volunteers also to attend some of the trainings and conferences. And for example, some of our volunteers have attended the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women training in their annual conference and thinking about their work by being a part of a larger community in that way.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Melissa, because I think everybody on the line is a rural VAWA grantee.
Right.
And we, you know, as you know, you've got to put in a certain chunk of money for training. But you can put in more than that if you want, and we have done that. The other thing is we, Rural VAWA, pays for our annual domestic violence volunteer training as well as our sexual assault advocate training.
Okay. So. Great. So let's talk a little bit also about, I want to just go back to what Mitzi said earlier about this sort of recognition of volunteers. You mentioned the Volunteer of the Year Award, and mm-hmm. we have done that also. And we've also partnered with other community agencies. So sometimes agencies will do things for us. And so we've also recognized agencies in our work and providing them with sort of or a business. If a business does something, you know, that really sort of go above and beyond any other group in the community, we'll also recognize that through our community and through recognition in the newspaper and gifts. And we've also, during Christmas time in our community, they have what's called chamber bucks. So not as a form of, you know, it's not cash payment, but it's just like they get $20 in chamber bucks just as a small token of appreciation during the holiday time. So it's money that they would then spend in our community at any business in the community as a way just to, I think it's some of those small gestures, I think, oftentimes, make, you know, that you're thinking about us, you recognize our work, and a small token of appreciation to people.
It goes a long, long way. So, for example, we just got a pretty sizable donation last week, and we had a little ceremony at the office, and the picture that went into the newspaper didn't have any staff members in it. It had our board chair, the woman who gave the donation, and then a bunch of our volunteers. And they were the ones that, you know, were on the front page of the newspaper. And, you know, most of them aren't looking for that, but it's a nice little bonus, you know, to see yourself in the newspaper and, wow, I really am a central part of this organization.
Right. Right. It does make a difference for them. So anything else before we open it up at the end, just to callers, things that Allison or Mitzi want to add on to that you think you just want to say a little bit more about before we open it up to questions?
You know, the only thing I would say is make sure you understand how your volunteers want to be contacted. So Melissa mentioned the listserv. That wouldn't work well in our community because, you know, not everybody is on the Internet. And we found over the years that everybody has an email address, but that doesn't mean they check their email. And so make sure you really ask that question, what's the best way for me to contact you? Because we just assumed, conveniently assumed that email was best and it was easiest for us, but it doesn't work. Some people require phone calls. Some people require snail mail. So make sure you understand that. Otherwise, you're just not going to hear from them.
And I guess the one thing that I'd like to, again, reiterate, it was something that I said at the beginning, is that this whole movement was begun by volunteers on a national scale, working in individual communities, and it's become part of our culture at this point. But volunteers started it. Volunteers came up with most of the theory and the ideas about it. I've been around long enough to remember when it was not discussed in universities, it was not part of medical school training, and all of this came out of volunteers. And so that really, I think, says how important they are to this movement. They're integral to what we do.
Okay, thank you. So, Liz, do we want to open it up?
Yeah, let's do so. So if you have a question or a comment to make, you can press the number 1 on your telephone and get into the question queue. And if you will, just remember to tell us where you're calling from and your name so we can make those connections. I just have a couple of clarifications, actually, for Allison and for Mitzi and for you, Melissa. And so you had talked just in the last few minutes, touched upon the whole notion of meeting collectively with your volunteers and doing ongoing training on a monthly basis. Mitzi and Allison, will you speak to some of the topics that you like to do the continuing education after your extensive training of
Sure.
your volunteers?
Sure. So during our extensive training, we bring in a lot of community professionals, such as the Victim Witness Program, the county attorney, the sheriff, but there are a lot of other agencies that we don't have time to bring in, so we bring those in afterwards. So just last month, Adult Protective Services came to tell us what they do and try to make that connection. The Office of Public Assistance, so they can explain Medicaid, TANF, things like that. We have had a suicide prevention expert come to talk about suicide. We have had our prevention education staff come in and talk about prevention education in the schools. Mitzi, what are some other current topics?
Well, we did a whole series, and this was not at our nightly trainings, but we opened up to volunteers, and many of them came. Legal advocate training. One was legal advice versus legal information. Clarifying what we can and can't do in the court system. We had one training on dissolution and parenting plans, how to fill out that paperwork. We had one on new initiatives that we are involved in. For instance, when we first got the VAWA funding, bring them in to talk about what that meant for us. I mean, it was a whole new era in what we could do in this community. So letting them know what all of that entailed. legislative. I mean, in the past we've done when the Montana legislature meets, talking about what bills are up and what bills affect our program and the survivors. Those are the kinds of things that we do.
You know, we've also brought in drug and alcohol, mental health experts.
Child and family services.
Yep. And that, you know, and that plays that plays a dual purpose, you know, obviously training our volunteers, but it's also helping build our relationships with our with other agencies, and it's been very powerful. You know, our coordinated community response work has always been challenging, and so for us, when the county attorney comes and trains and sees 15 people in the room, that sends a message. So if that makes sense, you know, the primary goal is training our volunteers, but it's also for our community partners to see that we've got a really vibrant group of people committed to this issue.
The other thing that we did not mention when we do our volunteer training, which we do once a year, which is problematic because obviously if you were to have a continual group of volunteers, you would probably want to do volunteer training a couple of times a year or three times a year. We don't have the staff or the resources to do that. So we do it once a year, but we've had in the past couple of years professionals from the community who want to come to the training. In fact, Child and Family Services came from Hardin, which is 120 miles away. They came for four evenings and one full Saturday, drove up from Hardin and back because they wanted that training. We've had nurses take it, we've had lawyers take it, and I think part of that is now speaking to the issues which are on the front page of the paper, but also on the front page of people's minds now. So that's been very gratifying to us. And we've opened it to them. So the volunteer training, they don't have to volunteer afterwards, and we let those people go through our training.
Well, thank you. That's all very helpful information and really good ideas for people to consider. So thank you. Stephanie, are there any questions or comments on the line?
At this time, we do have one guest in the queue.
Okay. Let's go ahead with that question, and then, Melissa, I have one question for you.
Okay.
Go ahead, caller.
Okay. That is Safe Shelter. Your line is open.
Okay. This is Dana again from Safe Shelter. I just have two questions, actually. I'm wondering if you guys, you were talking about about good training, doing really good training with your volunteers. Do you have any examples of that we can see, or get a hold of, or find on the internet? And then my other question is about recognizing your especially direct service volunteers. Is there ever any issue or concern about their safety of being recognized that way? I know, you know, about abusers seeking them out for, you know, to retaliate for them working with their wives or girlfriends or whatever.
Right. I'll address that second one first. We always ask our volunteers permission before we recognize them in any way.
Okay.
So, you know, we're gathered at the 24-hour training, and before I start whipping out my camera, I'm going to ask, you know, is there anyone who would prefer not to be identified?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that's a pretty easy way to get around that one, and it's a very good point.
Mm-hmm.
And some choose not to be on the front page of the paper.
Yeah.
And fair enough, and we totally respect that. In terms of training, we can share our materials with Liz, and she can take it through her channels and then get it out.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay, we'll see if that's better.
Go ahead, Missy. Were you gonna say something?
No, I was not.
Okay. All right. Dana, did we answer both of you? You had a question and a comment.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
I'm good.
Okay. Good. Great. Thank you. So, Melissa, my question was, you had referenced state laws governing what volunteers can and can't do. And so do you have any suggestions for how people can find out what, you know, the laws are that pertain to their own state?
Oh, Liz?
I'm sorry.
Oh, can, oh, do you hear that? Hang up.
Jeff, Jeff.
Can you hear me, Liz?
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
Yep. There we go.
All right. Yeah, for the best place to go is the coalition. So what every state has a, some sort of domestic violence coalition, and most of them have some sort of legal staff, but I would definitely call your statewide coalition and ask them.
Okay, good. That's good. Stephanie, are there any other questions or comments?
At this time, there are no additional guests in the queue.
Okay, and Allison and Mitzi, are you still on the line?
Mitzi is no longer on the line with us.
Okay. Allison, are you with us?
Must have lost our connection somehow.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So, sorry for the technical difficulty here, just in the last few minutes, but we are nearly at the end of our time. Melissa, is there any other things that you would like to kind of share or, you know, thoughts to leave the group with?
No, the only thing I would say is that, especially during these economic times in terms of funding, that a lot of work up front will pay great dividends in the end. I kind of sound like a Wall Street person when I say that, but I really mean that in terms of setting it up is all the work.
Yes.
But once you have the relationships and keeping them going is a lot less work. And once you establish the programming. So if people can find the time to do the work up front, you really, really, you broaden your community scope, you broaden the image of your community, you have resources in your community that you didn't have before, it relieves your staff. I mean, so the benefits are just abundant in terms of having active volunteers in your community and for the work that you need them to do.
I couldn't agree more.
Oh, so Allison, you are back on. We thought we lost you.
You did lose me.
Oh, okay, great. We told everyone we lost you, so when you started speaking, I was like, oh,
yeah,
good, she's back.
Yeah, no, I can't agree more. And, you know, it's hard to lift your head up and step out of the madness of delivering services every day, but, you know, it will pay off. And you know, just think about yourself and your overburdened staff who are taking the hotline every Christmas, every weekend. You know, you can get beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Make that initial investment.
Right. Well, so those are very good and relevant, inspiring kind of closing thoughts for our call today, that really it requires the commitment, but that the payoff will absolutely be there in the end, without a doubt. So we are about at the end of our time. I don't think Mitzi is with us, so...
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes. We can. Hi.
I was kicked out. I think our whole office was kicked out about a second or two ago. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thanks for dialing back in. Allison or Mitzi, is there anything else that you'd like to kind of wrap up with?
Well, I think that this is Mitzi. I would love to hear from other programs about what you're doing, you know, and what's happening there, and share some of the experiences that we have and how to build really vibrant volunteer programs. I think all of us could working together would really be a good thing.
Yeah, that's true. We learn from each other.
Yeah.
So the contact information for Melissa, Allison, and Mitzi is in the binder. You'll find the email addresses. So Mitzi is welcoming your comments and issues, further dialogue, so don't hesitate to share. Thank you both, Mitzi and Allison, for joining us. And Melissa, as always, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Anyway, everyone, thank you for joining us, and I'll look forward to talking with you again next month. So take care, and be sure to return your evaluation.
Bye-bye.